Now we're going to go into the far reaches of the human mind. How far do we go? In a moment, Stephen Schwartz joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Schwartz, Research Associate of Cognitive Sciences Laboratory of the Laboratories of Fundamental Research, is one of the world's experts on the practical applications of remote viewing and other aspects of extraordinary human functioning. You know, for almost 20 years, he was the research director and chairman of the Mobius Society. The laboratory carried out research into remote viewing, creativity, therapeutic intent, and other areas of human performance. And he's also the author or co-author of more than 30 technical papers, 4 books, and numerous magazines. And pieces of that, articles that went into them. Stephen is the editor of the Schwartz Report, an international daily web publication as well. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Stephen, welcome back. How are you?
How are you, George?
I'm doing great. And you look like you've been keeping very busy.
Well, I've been keeping moderately busy, yes. Yes, I've got Opening to the Infinite out, my new book, and we're continuing to work on the gold standard course, and so I'm trying to make information about non-local consciousness available to people.
I love the cover of Opening to the Infinite. As a little boy, strange story, I was thumbing through a kid's book. Gosh, I must have been 5 years old, Stephen. And I was mesmerized by a picture of a little boy reading a book next to his window. It was a bay window that had a shelf, a big enough shelf where a kid could just lie down on it.
Right.
And he was reading his book under the moonlight. And this picture just captured me. And this artist's rendition that you have of the lake looking like it's going into an ocean and the sun kind of reminds me a little bit about that. It just brings back great memories.
Well, that was done by a very well-known artist named Jonathan Meter, and who's an old friend. And I asked him if I could use that image, and it also has that Escher quality.
Yeah.
As the top of the window frame dissolves and you don't know which is cloud. Jonathan was gracious enough to let me use it. But thank you.
Opening to the Infinite, what does that mean?
Well, you know, I've gone through a lot of developments in my own consciousness and my own thinking about this, even since the last time we talked. And I increasingly am coming to see this as a capacity that all of us have to open to a realm of consciousness that is outside of time-space, and where not only can we obtain information, do we open to information, but we also have the capacity to affect other systems, either through what we call healing or therapeutic intention, and that we are interacting with one another in a variety of ways that we just are beginning to dimly understand.
Now, tell me what you feel to be the difference or similarities between non-local consciousness and non-local awareness. What is that?
Well, I think of non-local awareness as the personal experience. It's that moment, and it may have been that moment when you saw the picture of the boy on the ledge.
Uh-huh.
It's that moment that people have when they suddenly feel a connection to a greater whole. It's the kind of experience the religious ecstatic or the genius has. It's that personal connection with a greater whole, which I think of as non-local consciousness, which is the aggregate of all consciousness.
How did you, Stephen, get involved in all this?
Well, I got involved with it because I had an experience that or a series of experiences that forced me to confront the idea that there really was a part of us that was not just trapped inside of our brains. Because I had, like anybody who'd gone through a research training, I mean, I had come to think of consciousness as just something going on in the brain. It was no brain, no consciousness. And I came to realize, I sort of confronted it, that you really, if you looked at the data honestly, you had to acknowledge that something was going on, that some part of us exists outside of time-space. The near-death studies the reports about reincarnation, the reports of precognitive dreams that people have, all that stuff. When you really forget about all the trappings about it and just look at what is the nature of this experience, you come away with the idea that there is a part of us that exists outside of time-space.
You know, it's almost as if consciousness, and I believe this, exists outside of the brain, not in the brain.
Well, Wilder Penfield, who was one of the developers of brain mapping a number of years ago, in his final book, Mysteries of the Mind, wrote that whatever the brain was, it was not the mind, that you could hurt the brain and hurt the mechanism, but that did not mean that you hurt the operator. And I think it's actually a synthesis of both. There is a portion of the mind that is brain specific, and there are other portions of consciousness which endure independent of the brain itself.
I'm beginning to wonder, Stephen, if the mind maybe just kind of floats around your body on the exterior portion of your body.
Well, there are a number of people have thought that. I do think a part of the brain is stored in the neuroanatomy of the brain.
True.
That part of consciousness is stored within the neuroanatomy
right.
of the brain. But, you know, if you look at everything from how do savants know what they know? How do kids who are 3 years old start writing symphonies? I mean, that's a complicated skill set. Where does that come from? It's not like you're just it's sort of hardwired into you. When a child comes back with a particular injury and says, well, I got this injury in a previous life because I was killed by a man with an axe as I was climbing out of my lover's window. And he has this kind of injury, and they go back, and sure enough, there was a person of that name, and that's exactly what happened to him. When you look at the near-death studies, people who have been clinically brain dead, and yet they report, as you've had many people on, I'm sure, on
mm-hmm.
the show, what is that part of us? And these are not each independent things. If you look at them, as I believe the research is trying to tell us to look at them, as a whole, you see that over and over again we encounter evidence that some part of consciousness exists outside of time-space.
Does it frustrate you when you talk to scientists and they think everything is physical? The brain is physical. The functioning is all physical. And they don't understand that there's something else out there?
Well, it can be very frustrating because what usually happens when you talk to people who have very hard opinions about something like this and they dismiss all of the evidence out of hand, when you say to them, well, what specifically is it about, pick the experiment you want, that is wrong? Where is the flaw in this research that invalidates its conclusion? And over again, you find out, well, they've never actually bothered to read any of the research. They just have an attitude about it. And yes, there are a significant number of people who are sort of paradigm bound, I guess. They go into reality vertigo when you talk to them or show them information that doesn't conform with their idea of the way the world works. But people do change. You know, Carl Sagan went through a significant change. He began as a complete physicalist, and in his last book, he made a point of saying there are several areas of non-local consciousness. That's not the way he describes it. He says there are several areas of research which need to have serious study, and he lists these. These are all non-local consciousness research areas. People do change as they are exposed to the information if they will take the time and have a sufficiently open mind to actually look at the data.
Now I put you on the spot, Stephen. How did it come about?
How did what come
this
about?
This consciousness.
Where does consciousness begin?
Uh-huh.
I think to answer that question properly, George, I'd have to have sandals and a robe.
That's right. You're close. You're close.
My personal feeling, My personal feeling is that consciousness predates physicality. Only date is wrong. You see, part of the problem with this is that it's almost impossible to have a conversation about it because so much of our language is time-space bound. In Opening to the Infinite, when I wrote that book, I got all the way through it. And I read it. I sat down one night to read it just to sort of get a sense of it because when you write a book, you write each chapter and you kind of lose, you know, it just becomes very intense.
Yeah, you're looking for flow.
Yeah, and so I began to read it and I realized that I had to rewrite the whole book because my language was entirely time-space bound. You know, it's the idea that there's a signal, that there's a sender, that there's a receiver, all those sort of electromagnetic models. It's the wrong way to conceptualize it. It's about opening. I think the evidence is telling us that it's as if we are fish swimming around in a sea, if you will, of interconnectedness. And we don't bring it up to our conscious mind, but it's there just beneath the surface. And it emerges periodically, particularly in moments of high stress or high emotion, which is why people see ghosts or they have premonitions, that sort of thing. I tend to believe now that consciousness is causal and physicality is its manifestation.
You know, every time I see a picture that Hubble has taken or one of these incredible new pieces of satellite machinery we've got, I think about what you just said, and that is the fact that consciousness was around way before any of this even started. What I can't figure out, and like you just said, you need a sandals and a robe, is the design for this. This couldn't happen by accident, Stephen.
Yeah, actually, you know, I was in a debate not long ago between evolutionists and creationists.
You were right in the middle.
And I was actually right in the middle because I asked both of them. I said to the creationist, what is it about evolution that violates your understanding of deity?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why can't God have set evolution in
motion?
Yes, I mean, the cells operate in a certain way. I mean, what is it that precludes God from having created evolution? And I asked the evolutionist, what is it in evolution that precludes some intelligent design that set the whole thing in motion? And neither one of them had an answer for this.
Which means you are the correct one.
Well, I think so. I think we need to get out of our boxes and really sort of take off the blinders and look at what the evidence is trying to tell us. And that is that all consciousness is, I believe, is interconnected and interdependent. I mean, we know from these studies that have been done, for instance, the therapeutic intent studies where with conscious intention, somebody causes another system to another organism, whether it's a cell colony or insects or small animals or people, to create effects. It all suggests that there is some kind of linkage that's going on. Otherwise, how would it happen? I just think we're being driven to look at the world in a very different way.
Do you think, Stephen, if there's life out there on other planets, life like ours, we've got probably a pretty good chance of guessing that they have consciousness too, that they're all tapped into what we're tapped into?
Yes. I think at some level this is all interconnected. I just think the idea that we are the only sentient species in the universe, in the many universes,
the multiverses.
Yeah, I mean, it's so preposterous. It's such an act of arrogant hubris that I can't take it seriously. I mean, as you say, if you look at the Hubble images, for instance, and you realize that you're looking at millions and millions of planets, how can you possibly think that we're the only people?
When we're beginning to find out, just in our own solar system, that the complexities of other planets you know, is very similar. I think we've got the big gas planets and we've got the smaller ones, but we're beginning to find liquid methane, frozen methane, liquid water. I mean, the similarities are incredible. I think the little organisms that we're all part of are all over the place.
I think you're right. How did life begin on Earth? What was it that quickened it? I mean, it's not immediately apparent that it's some sort of chemical reaction or anything remotely like that. And when they began trying to create artificial intelligence with computers, thinking that the neural networks of computers would mimic the brain, it turns out it just doesn't work like that. I think that there are many levels of information that we are only just very tentatively beginning to be aware of.
The man or woman who's trying to make a living for their families, for their loved ones, they go to work, they get their paycheck, you know, they live in a nice house, a small house, no house, who knows. They have a television and a radio, maybe none. But they try to make a living. They're trying to carve out an existence on this planet as well as they can. What does this all mean to them if they are able to understand what we're going to talk about tonight? And that's the consciousness and the ability to be aware.
Well, I think what you get out of it at just the simplest practical level is that once you begin seeing that all consciousness is interlinked and interdependent, and you recognize that, and that the interaction of these linkages of consciousness create fields. That's a hand-waving term, I admit it, but for want of a better term, fields. My friend Rupert Sheldrake calls them morphogenetic fields.
Right. Lynn McDaggert calls it the field.
The field, yeah. I mean, there are lots of ways of approaching this. It's a kind of organizing that's created by intention. And when you realize that, let me give it to you in another historical experience of mine. I lived through Watergate.
Me too.
I was in government. I knew many of the people that were involved. I was the special assistant to a man named Elmo Zumwalt at that time. And as I met all these various kinds of people and I watched Watergate unfold both from the inside and the outside, as it were, I came to believe that Watergate really was all the pencils everybody had stolen from the office. It was the aggregate. It was a kind of...
It was all of it.
Yes, we are all complicit in this. That's the part that's hard for people to, I think, both understand and accept, is that they are empowered, because there's so many things in our experience in life that tell us we're unempowered. But if you look at what's going on in the world today, I mean, let me give you an example. If you look at the jihadists, for instance, what motivates them? It's a shared idea. It's a shared perspective that leads them to make small individual choices. These are quite ordinary people. It has them making particular kinds of choices. If you look at national character, I mean, if you fly in an airplane in Europe across between France and Germany, there's nothing when you look down out of the airplane that says this part is France and this part is Germany. There's no line that you see on the ground. And yet no Frenchman would ever mistake himself for a German or would be taken for a German and the other way around. Why? Because of thousands and thousands and thousands of little acts of choice that create the culture that these people are embedded in, the choices about what foods you eat, what music you listen to, what drink you drink, how you get married, how you get buried, how you treat your children. All of those thousands and thousands of little mundane daily decisions in aggregate create national character.
Stephen, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment as we get into now opening to the infinite. Specifically, we're going to talk about remote viewing and some death experiences, and I can't wait until it's phone time with you. I'll be back. Stephen, was that Admiral Zumwalt that you worked with?
Yes.
Ah, okay. I spent 9 years in the Navy and remember his name well, though he was before my time. He was in there with the Rickovers, that kind of reputation.
That's exactly right. Yes. I was his speechwriter and a sort of in-house civilian think tank, and I knew Admiral Rickover and almost wrote a biography of him.
Rickover was a genius. I did get that book. Somebody did write a biography on him.
They did. The guy that was originally my researcher, Norman Pulmar, and another fellow, Tim Allen, who worked at Geographic, wrote it.
Not the comedian.
No. Well, very nice guy, but no, not the comedian.
Did Zumwalt ever admit to you about underwater UFO bases or anything like that?
No, but I will tell you something quite interesting. When I got into that post, when I was asked to do that, I decided that I would look at the Philadelphia experiment.
Aha! Tell me.
See whether it was for real or not.
What'd you find out?
Well, I mean, and I had the clearances I could get at stuff, and so I really looked into it. It never happened. That's the headline. What did happen was that the Navy became very concerned about magnetic mines, and they began running a series of tests at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. They built a degaussing wharf, which was basically big electromagnets, and they would take the ships through these magnetic fields with the idea that this would change their magnetic alignment.
Okay,
right, make them less susceptible to the mines. And, of course, somebody had to be aboard the ship. And in those days, we're speaking here in very early, people didn't really understand the effects that living organisms had when they were placed in big magnetic fields.
Right.
They just didn't know very much about it. And so there were cases of sailors on the skeleton crew that took the, I can't think of the name of the destroyer that was.
Eldridge. The
Eldridge. Right. And that took the Eldridge through. The story traces back to a man named Ivan Sanderson, whom I knew, and who used to write sort of popular books about paranormal
yes.
and sort of weird things.
He was one of the best at his time.
Yeah, he was very good. This is in the 50s, up in the early 60s. He's long dead now. And Ivan was told this story by somebody at the Pentagon who waved some sort of paper in front of him. Anyway, he was never very clear, and in those days when I first met him, I was much younger, and I couldn't press him but so hard. But anyway, the story traces to him, and he wrote it up, and then Charlie Berlitz, from the mm-hmm. son of the founder of the Berlitz School of
right.
Languages.
Who went on to write about the Bermuda Triangle.
That's right.
Like that. Yeah.
And Atlantis. Yeah, Charlie, who spoke 32 languages and was a very interesting guy, he picked up from Ivan, and he wrote a book about it, which popularized it even more.
I remember reading that book.
Yeah.
Drove me crazy. I loved it.
And then it was picked up, and a television program was made about it. Rod Serling was involved with it. And it just sort of became an urban legend.
And then a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So I climbed up inside of it. I got all of the original records, the logs of the Eldridge. I went and actually interviewed people who were in the Philadelphia Navy Yard at that time.
This is incredible. I mean, it happened, but not the way they say it happened.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. What happened was men did go through high energy magnetic fields. It did produce strange psychotic behaviors, as it does.
Yes.
There's now a whole literature on this. But the ship didn't disappear. Nobody walked through walls.
People didn't get, meshed into the into the boat or anything like that.
Right.
The ship.
So, I mean, it just, I'll tell you an even better one, the one that's in Opening to the Infinite that I told, and I don't think anybody's ever put together before, and that is how the American government got into the non-local consciousness research game.
All right, tell us. I love these stories.
What happened was, and this is in Opening to the Infinite, what happened was a guy named Mazière, who was a French journalist, wrote in an obscure French periodical saying that the American Navy had carried out an experiment aboard the nuclear submarine Nautilus, which was the very first nuclear submarine, and that they had established this telepathy connection, as he described it. So he wrote this up, and the KGB read it, and they took it seriously. So they began, they thought, well, God, if the Americans are doing this kind of research, we better get started. And they already had an interest in it. Notably, there were some very prominent and very, very fine scientists, a man named Vasiliev, for instance, who began testing whether this kind of consciousness is electromagnetic. And he began the experiments, which I finally finished with the submarine experiment Deep Quest, which is also in the book, and the whole story of that. But anyway, the KGB took it seriously, and so they set up a program. And in due course, the American intelligence community began, through their human intelligence network, they began to get wind of this program. And so they went back and said, well, my God, if the Russians are taking this seriously, we got to take it seriously. And so that's how they approached Hal Puthoff, who was then a Naval Intelligence Reserve officer and a laser physicist, and Russ Targ, and that's how the SRI program got started. And so when you trace it all back, you find out that a bogus
story
written by Mazier, he worked with another writer, and they wrote a book called Morning of the Magician. And I went back and tracked, he wasn't alive anymore, but I tracked his partner down, who told me part of this. And so on the basis of a bogus story in an obscure French periodical, the Soviet intelligence apparatus began to put together a consciousness research program, which in turn was picked up by the Americans, and it was all based on a bogus experiment on an American submarine that never happened.
Jeez. It almost backfired on us.
Well, I just like the irony of each side beginning something on the belief of the other side, all made up by this utterly obscure French journalist. I mean, Mazier, nobody in the States had ever heard of him. This little journal that he published in this small circulation, and yet because it was considered to be a genuine leak that he had gotten hold of, all everything that flowed out of it subsequently that we're all talking about, and out of it came the one school of the development of remote viewing.
How did you key, though we talk about a lot of things in the book, Opening to the Infinite, how did you key in on remote viewing, or why?
Well, I actually came to it entirely on my own based on studying the Edgar Cayce material. I got interested in the aspects of the Cayce material which could be validated. I mean, that you could really find evidential material about it. And as I looked at it, I began to ask myself, well, what is it that how does he get this information? I mean, where does he go? And who stores it? How does it get stored? Where does it come from? Because I knew it to be highly accurate. You asked me earlier, what got me interested in all this, one of the things was that I went down to Virginia Beach, and I was taken up by someone that I had met to look at the Cayce material. I'd never heard of him. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know anything about any of this. And I had been working for National Geographic before I'd been drafted. This is all back in the Vietnam era, and early Vietnam era. And I pulled off the shelf a notebook with his readings, and it had a reading that he gave in 1936 for a woman in which he said she had been a member of the Essene community, and he described where this community was, and I recognized it as Kirbit Qumran, and he said she had been a teacher of astrology.
All right.
And the hair stood straight up on my head, because the last thing I had done for the Geographic before I went into the service was research on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so it was a subject I was conversant with. And I knew that in 1936, nobody knew that Kirbit Qumran existed. Nobody knew that there were women who were part of the Essene community, and nobody knew that the Essenes were interested in astrology, which is what he said, that she was a teacher of astrology.
So this really woke you up.
Absolutely, because I thought, it was not until 1947 that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered by a young Bedouin herdsman who chucked a rock in a cave mouth and heard it hit something and went in to look. That's how the scrolls were discovered.
They were just sitting in there all these years.
In these urns that they were.
Yeah.
And I knew that the scrolls themselves talked about this fascination with astrology, and that excavations at Kirbet Qumran, which at that point was thought to be a minor outpost of the Emperor Vespasian's legions that had been built for the Jewish uprising in AD 68, and nobody had ever thought of it as an Essene community. The Essenes were described by Josephus, who was the main source of information about them, as this schismatic monastic order of Jewish monks, all men, who lived out in the desert. And so I thought, well, how could Casey possibly have known that there were women in the community? There were, where the skeletons were found. How could he have known about the interest in astrology? The scrolls themselves speak of it. How could he have known that Kirbet Qumran was, in fact, an Essene community? I mean, that information lay 11 years in the future. And so I thought, well, you know, I called it distant viewing for about 15 years.
Okay.
Until I met, I didn't meet Hal and Russ until 1976, I guess, when I invited them to take part in the submarine experiment. And so from 67, 68, when I was doing this research, to 10 years later, I called this distant viewing, and I got interested in studying it from the point of view of archaeology, because I wanted to develop an experiment that would be interesting enough to be successful, that didn't just rely on a statistical analysis, because people find statistics hard to understand, whereas if you can find Cleopatra's palace, you know, it kind of cuts through the chase. And
like they just found Herod's tomb.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And so I got interested in developing a technique for using it in archaeology. And as I began to do research on that, I discovered that people had been doing it actually for about 100 years. Going back to Frederick Bligh Bond, who reconstructed Glastonbury Cathedral, and Stefan Osowiecki in Poland, who worked with a man named Poniatowski, who was the leading ethnographer of Poland during the war, and whose experiments they took so seriously that even though at the risk of being killed if they were discovered, because archaeology in Poland was outlawed by the Nazis, and if they caught you practicing it, they killed you.
Even though Hitler dabbled in the occult.
No, but he had a point of view. See, he was looking for his occult, you know, the spear of Longinus and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they didn't want to have any early man research that was coming out that would contradict their construction about how the world, you know, the history of the world. So they just wouldn't allow anybody to do it. And I mean, they wouldn't. In one case that I tracked down, an archaeologist was getting married, and the Nazis came in and dragged him out of the church in the middle of the ceremony and put the bride, the groom, the priest, and the entire wedding party up against the wall of the church and machine gun.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, to carry out these experiments during the war, during occupied Warsaw, was a serious deal. And yet, a whole group of scientists accompanied by Poniatowski, or led by Poniatowski, carried out these experiments with Osowiecki about early man research in Poland. And then I found the great Olmec head that, you know, you used to see on the tequila ads. And a number of other things were all uncovered by a man named Clarence Woolsey Wyatt, and he used a shaman as a remote viewer, or as I called it then, a distant viewer. So I gradually put together the stories of 100 years of research, and that became the book, The Secret Vaults of Time.
Okay.
So then I've carried it on from there, but I originally was just looking for a way of doing an experiment that I thought had a high probability of success, because it's exciting to do this kind of work, and that makes a difference. and that would give unequivocal results that you just couldn't argue about.
Stephen, we're going to talk a lot about remote viewing when we turn the corner here at the top, but let me ask you this. The Spear of Destiny, of course, that Hitler was looking for. Why was he so interested in that?
Well, because it traces back to a book written by a man named Johann Walter Stein, who was disciple's not the right word, who was a follower of Rudolf Steiner, the founder of anthroposophy. And Stein wrote a manuscript which the Nazis got hold of, and which traces a kind of occult history. It's sort of like Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code.
There's some kind of legend behind the spear, isn't
yes,
there?
Yes, that Longinus pierced the spear, and that whoever would control the spear could rule the world.
Right, right, right.
And so Hitler was determined to find it, and also these other things that were mentioned by Stein in his manuscript, which was later, by the way, picked up by a man named Trevor Constable, who wrote a book called The Spear of Destiny. And that's what really brought it into modern consciousness.
Do you think, has it been found? It's in a museum somewhere,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that they have it on display. I haven't looked into it for years now, but they have what they think is the spear. I mean, you know.
Well, now, let me ask you this. Can they look at that spear? Is there still blood on it? And can they...
Oh, yes.
You know where I'm headed here.
Of course. Can you get Jesus' DNA?
Yes.
That is actually a very interesting question, and you know I don't know the answer to that. When I was looking into all of this stuff, and I knew Trevor Constable, and I met Stein's at Emerson College in England, a very elderly man had been a very close friend of Stein's, and he had given him the manuscript. There were only two copies, and he gave it to me to read. When all of that was going on, that's pre-DNA, and I haven't really looked at this question since the development of DNA, and so I don't actually know the answer, but... You know, the latest work on the Shroud is causing everybody to re-examine the Shroud again, so you raise a very interesting point.
That would be fascinating. Stephen, you've got a number of websites, but this brand new book, Opening to the Infinite, is it out yet?
It is out. You have a copy.
Well, I have a copy. I thought you might have given me the pre-copy, but this is it, huh?
No, that's it.
Okay.
The book is out, and I spent the last 3 years writing it. I've rewritten it a number of times. It says everything I know about the subject of non-local consciousness, and it also contains very explicit instructions about how to get in touch with this part of yourself. I tried to make it so that it was very accessible to people and that anybody could follow the real simple instructions, and they would be able to have these experiences and be able to prove them to themselves that they'd actually done it.
Well, this is fascinating. Websites, so I've got a whole handful of them. Which ones do you recommend?
To get the book, you go to Amazon. You go to my own personal website, stephanaschwartz.com. That's stephanaschwartz. You all have very graciously, I think, put it up on your website.
Of course. It's the least we could do for you, Steve.
Absolutely. And my daily web publication is theschwartzreport.net. And that's a daily web publication I do every day, doesn't have any cost. And it's not only about this, it's about trends that are shaping the future.
All right, stay with us. Stephen Schwartz, our special guest. Now we're going to really get into remote viewing in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM, so don't touch your dial. Now, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Stephen Schwartz, our special guest. We're talking now remote viewing. Stephen, first of all, what do you find the relationship of remote viewing to this consciousness and awareness that we talked about earlier?
Well, I think the way to think about remote viewing is as a protocol, a kind of technique, very much like a kind of modern mental martial art or a form of mental yoga that allows you to quiet yourself and trains you to be able to open to this aspect of consciousness, which from which you can get all this information that can be tested. Remote viewing is a protocol that we designed back in the early 70s, and it's still pretty much as it was then, in which you get the information in a way that can be independently validated. That was the whole point of remote viewing, is not only did you teach people how to open to this aspect of themselves, but you gave them a way of independently verifying what they had experienced so that it wasn't just sort of a general feeling or speculation. It was hard information. Typically in a remote viewing experiment that I do, for instance, most of mine are precognitive. That means that at the time that I'm asking the question, there is no target. It hasn't been selected yet. Or if it's an archaeological experiment, it's something that everybody acknowledges. Nobody knows where it is. So if you can get testable information about a target that hasn't even been selected yet, that lies in the future, or that you can describe locate a site and then describe what you're going to find when you go there, it's very clear that you didn't do this by just guessing or taking a wild shot.
You do believe that this is complicated to learn? I touch a little bit about this.
No, I think it's simple to learn.
I do, too.
I think you can teach, in Opening to the Infinite and in the gold standard DVD-CD set that we've got, which is a set that has presentations by everybody in remote viewing, all the major figures, the point that comes away from that is that almost anybody can learn to do this. Now, some people are better at it than others because some people are better baseball players or golfers or musicians or mathematicians. You know, it's spread through the population as a skill, very much like any other human ability. But learning how to do it is, if you follow the rules, and I spell them out in considerable detail, it's very simple. I mean, this is something that you know how to do instinctively. You just have to train yourself to listen to it.
Fascinating. Now, tell me about some of your techniques.
Well, I mean, basically, I am entirely data-driven. I'm interested in stuff where there is evidence to prove that it works. And so the approach that I have to remote viewing, which is the approach that we originally developed in science, which is quite simple, is predicated on how the experiment is structured. I do, for instance, it's very important what kind of target you use. I try to use targets that are highly numinous. That means that they have a high emotional resonance for the people that are doing the viewing, because those kinds of targets are easier to see. There are targets that have entropic process in them. Are easier to see, whether that's a lightning bolt or, for instance, I got into this by using the aircraft carrier Enterprise, because I happen to have a picture of it that was in a file, and I used that as a target, and people never described it as a ship. They would describe it as this huge metal island because it's too big. They couldn't really see it as a boat. They couldn't think of a boat that big. But what interested me was that they would describe over and over again that there's a sun inside of this thing, or it's like they have a star in a bottle. Now, there's nothing in the picture that you could see that would tell you that it was a nuclear-powered ship, and yet these people would describe what was clearly the nuclear reactor.
What was the incredible Ben Kingsley movie where he was a remote viewer? Just came out about
it. Suspect Zero.
Yes, yes. I like that movie.
Well, you know, the thing is that it's amazing how much of this is actually going on. For instance, the first use of remote perception in that I can find is occurs with Croesus, you know, rich as Croesus. He did a remote viewing experiment that was almost exactly the same as we would do it today. His country, the Lydians, had been attacked, and his son had been killed. He was very depressed. And just to make things even worse, his scouts came and said to him, you know, you're about to be attacked by the Persians. And so he said, well, geez, I mean, you know, what am I going to do here? The Persians are big and powerful, and I'm not. And And what should I do? And so he decided that he would ask one of the oracles. But then the question was, well, which oracle should he trust? Because what if they didn't give him the same answer? So his solution was the first remote viewing experiment. It's described in the 46th chapter of Herodotus. He says he had seven embassies assembled. That's seven groups of people, basically. And he sends one out to each of the seven classical oracles of the ancient world, and he tells them all that they must wait for the 100th day from the day they leave. They all left on the same day.
Right.
And that the question that they were to ask was, what is Croesus doing? And so he sent them out, and they all thought this was sort of mad. But anyway, the only one whose answer we know in detail, because it was the correct one, and it was recorded and preserved for that reason, is the answer that Delphi gave. So the embassy went out to Delphi, and which, as you probably know, was a temple, and there was a young girl in a swing kind of thing, in a kind of tripod, and she was over a crack in the earth that had hallucinogenic gases came up. And so she's in a kind of altered state. She was open to non-local consciousness, is the way I would describe it. And when they walked into the room on the 100th day, they waited. They got there early. They had to wait around for a while. On the 100th day, just as predicted, or just as requested, they went into the chamber of the Pythias, the young girl, as she was known. And before they even asked their question, she said, I count the sands of the days, and I see a great bronzen urn, and in it is a ram and a cock and a turtle, and I see this great bronze lid and a fire. And so they duly took all this down, and they went back to Croesus's court, and when they got there and they told him what the oracle had said, he bowed down and made obeisance, because he had decided that on the 100th day he would do something that was utterly out of character. What's the most unkingly thing I could do? And he decided that what he would do was to have a big tripod erected in his courtyard, and this big bronze pot brought in filled with water, and he personally killed this cock and the ram and the turtle and threw them into the pot and put the big bronze lid on it exactly as she had described. And that is a classic outbound remote viewing experiment.
You know, I've practiced this, Stephen, and I'm getting pretty good at it, along with intuition. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think they cross over.
It is the same thing.
Yeah. We have this incredible ability. We just have to recognize it.
That's right.
And do you believe that children can do it, men can do it, women can do it? Are any three of the better than the other?
No. The research says that what matters is not your gender. Both men and women are good at this. Extroverts have one strategy for doing it. Introverts have another strategy. But basically what it requires is the ability to open to this signal within yourself. It's not something coming into you, but it's like, see right there, I got trapped in the word signal. It's like you open to, it's like a sunrise occurs. The sun comes up and suddenly what was dark is now light. And so it's very much like having a kind of daydream. And in fact, it's an extraordinarily intimate process. When you do lots and lots of remote viewing sessions with people, and I've done thousands of these things, it's very much like having permission to watch somebody daydream. And so the way I do it is very relaxed. It should be done in a very playful mood. I ask people to relax. I take them through a little relaxation. I ask them to make a little drawing just to sort of fix it in time space. They're exactly the same kind of little drawings that scientists make when they're having a moment of genius. They make a little sketch to sort of fix it in their minds. And I ask people to make a little sketch, just very simply. People who believe they can do it do better than people who don't believe they can do it.
And what's the hit rate? What do you think? Out of 10, what's successful? 5?
We expect
six?
To see between 75 and 85% of the material be judged correct or partially correct.
That's all right. That's pretty good. That's very good.
You can become quite good at this. I have seen people staggeringly good at it. I mean, just amazingly good at it. In fact, I once was on the Merv Griffin show, and they asked me, Merv asked me if I would, rather than have a musical startup, you know, they do a little startup routine before the show actually
right.
starts to sort of warm up the audience. And he said, listen, would you do a remote viewing, you know, sort of live right there? I walked on stage and before the show started, and he was talking to the floor producer, and he said, you know, would you do this? I had no preparation. I said, okay. I had some pictures that I had brought that I was going to use for something else. And I had a set of 7 pictures. And I said, okay, to the audience, I said, if you'll pass out pieces of paper and pencils, and we'll do this. And so I took them through a remote viewing. I said, close your eyes, take a deep breath. I'm going to show you something in 30 minutes, and it's a physical place, and I want you to draw a picture of it, what you see. And then I walk them through. Okay, look at your life size. Look to your left. Look to your right. Look down at your feet. And what do you see?
Because
all those
you have to give
questions.
You have to give them a target, right?
Well, no, at that point, there was no target.
None.
I didn't know what the answer was.
Okay, okay.
And I knew it was going to be one of those 7 pictures because I had them in my pocket.
Right.
But I didn't know which one. And so I got the information, and I asked the ushers in the audience, about 140 people in the audience, and I asked them to collect them, and they did. And then just as the show was starting, Merv came back and said, well, is this going to work? I said, I don't have any idea if it's going to work, but I presume it'll work. It works every time I've done it in the past. So we got into the show, and he said, okay, I understand you did a remote viewing before we started the show. I said, yes. And he said, well, what's the target? And I said, well, I don't know yet. You have to pick a number between 1 and 7. And I had asked the floor producer, I gave him the 7 pictures, and I said, number them from 1 to 7, just randomly, whatever you want. And now we're up on stage, and the show's going, and I said to Merv, well, pick a number between 1 and 7. He said, 5. I said, okay, that's the target. He said, well, didn't you have a target when you did it? I said, no, I didn't have a target when I did it. These people had to go down the timeline in order to get the information that they needed. So I said, okay, to the camera guy, could you put up target number 5? And I had all these little blue cards, and we went to commercial, and I, sitting there on the thing, very quickly went through, and there were a half a dozen of these things, maybe a dozen, that just absolutely stood out. If I'd been standing there, if the person had been standing there looking at it, he couldn't have drawn a better picture. The target for this was the new House office building and the Capitol complex in Washington, D.C. I'm in Los Angeles where the show is. And so that was a picture. I had a picture taken from a helicopter of the Capitol and the new office building. And so there were several of these pictures that were just, and one of them was, first of all, it was very artistically done, and second of all, it was just, you could not have done better if you'd been standing in the helicopter drawing it with a pad.
That's amazing.
So I said to the guy, Gary, whatever his name, Wilkinson, what I think was his name, and I said, is there a Gary Wilkinson? And Merv looked out, you know, and they turned the house up, and this homeless guy stood up. and Merv said to him, well, what's your name? I'm Gary. Well, and he said, well, Gary, where do you live? And Gary said, well, most nights I live at the corner of Sunset and Vine. And
in a box.
In a box, yes.
Yeah.
And he had just wandered into the show, and they let him in, but he was a wonderful remote viewer. In another case that I describe in Opening to the Infinite, I had 47 people describe where Saddam Hussein was a month before he was found.
Did 47 people said this?
Yes.
Out of how many?
47 people did it, and out of the consensual analysis, I was able to describe, from their consensual information, I had a description of the house, where he was hiding, that he was hiding in a little carved-out room or cave mm-hmm. under the house, that he would have only two or three supporters, that he would look like a homeless person with wild salt and pepper gray and black hair.
And he did, yeah.
That he would have a box of money with him. That he would be armed but would put up no resistance, that he would only have two or three followers with him, that the house that he was at was in a little village outside the city of Tikrit, that there was a road that ran in front of the house, there were large palm trees on each end of the house, it had a little half-second story, and that there was a river out of the back. And there is, and you can go, it's in the book, there is no other dwelling anywhere near this that looks anything like this. I later had a communication with one of the officers that was involved with his recovery and who said, if I'd had this information, I could have gotten in a Humvee and driven out. I know exactly where it was. And it's all in there. And then we had everything notarized, all these predictions notarized, and I turned them over to a third party, and he put them in a vault, which is where they are to this day. And I worked off of, I did an analysis based on photocopies and posted, talked to a lot of people about what I had seen. So there were lots of people who knew about all this. And yeah, they were extraordinarily accurate. I was blown away.
Can these people start remote viewing what they think might be out there in the universe? Can they visit other planets?
Yes, we know that Ingo Swann and Harold Sherman went out to Mars, Mercury, and Jupiter before the space probes got there, and the things they described later proved, which violated what was then known, what common wisdom was at the time, turned out to be exactly correct. So as far as we can tell, time and space are not issues. I mean, I've had people go back thousands of years to locate buried sites.
It's almost like time traveling without the machine.
Yes. Yes, it's like having a daydream about the past, which you can then test by going to the site and digging down and seeing what's actually there. Or it's used in criminology. It's widely used in criminology. The earliest criminology case that I know about is a 14th century French dowser named Jacques Aymer, who used it to solve a murder. And this was all very carefully written down at the time and preserved and comes down to us to this day. And Aymer solved a crime that had really disturbed people. This merchant was murdered and his wife, and this guy found the murderer. There were several murderers. He found one of them, and the other three had split off, and they raced after them, and they got to them just after they had crossed the border into another country, and therefore they couldn't be arrested. But everything he said turned out to be correct, and he became a national hero at the time.
You mentioned Ingo Swann. He was a staunch friend of my aunt, a psychiatrist, who wrote a book on what we're talking about now, basically. He saw structures on the moon, Steve, and I think what he might have seen weren't extraterrestrial. I think they were ours from a long time ago.
It's possible. It's possible. I mean, I know Ingo, and I have a lot of respect for Ingo. He really coined the term remote viewing. As I said, I used to call it distant viewing.
Yep, stay with us, Stephen. We'll be back with more in just a moment. The next hour, we'll open up the phone lines as well. We'll get into near-death experiences and reincarnation next. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about what dreams do with this kind of remote viewing. Does it strengthen them, make it better?
Well, there are several things that I think are important about dreams. Yes, you can do remote viewing in a lucid dream state. There was research done by Steve LaBerge, who really created the whole field of research on lucid dreams. A lucid dream is a dream, many people have had them naturally, where you're in a dream and you wake up in the dream and you can take control of it and make it go where you want it to go. and it's an extraordinary experience when you've had one. He developed techniques that would let you do it on a fairly regular basis. And he worked with Joe McMonigle, who's probably been on the show
and he's one of the best.
Absolutely one of the great remote viewers. Lovely man. And Joe began working with Ed May, who was at SAIC at that point. And the research they did, they would do a standard remote viewing, only they would wait until Joe woke up in the dream, and then they he was pre-instructed to do a remote viewing, and then they would wake him up, and he would provide his description, make a little drawing, and then they would pick the target and make the comparisons. And in Opening to the Infinite, I've got one of the examples of the drawing that he made and then the picture, which was extraordinary act of remote viewing. However, for Joe, it got to be very disconcerting, he said, because he got to a point where he couldn't tell whether he was awake in his dream or whether he was awake or whether he was asleep. And he said in one case he was sitting there having a conversation and everything seemed to be perfectly normal. He was sure he was awake when somebody came in as a rhinoceros. And he realized that he was in a lucid dream. And he said, I just got scared. It got to a place where I couldn't quite tell what state I was in. So that, I think, is an interesting area of research, but there hasn't been, understandably, a whole lot done with it. But there are, Dale Graft, who was part of the original SRI group, Dale has put a lot of energy in, and I have a long description of how this works in Opening to the Infinite. He has what he calls a dream crafting technique, where you give yourself a suggestion that the last dream of the night, that you will remember that dream and only that dream, and that you will give yourself a remote viewing task. And he's had some quite extraordinary results. And then another, a Princeton-trained psychologist, Henry Reed, who's a good friend who has been also working with dreams. Henry has done an adaptation of the technique that I used for the archaeological and criminological work, and he's recreated the dream experience that they did at the Temple of Aesculapius at Epidaurus. Aesculapius was the god of healing in the classical world, and his principal temple was at Epidaurus, and people would come from all over, and they would go into what was called the abaton, and they would meet with a therapeutai. That's a person. That's where we get the word therapeutics. And these were people who were temple attendants, and they would prepare the person. They would go through fasting and that ritual activity, and ritual is important because it allows you to focus your intention. And then you would give yourself the suggestion that you would have a dream, and then the next morning the therapeutai would help you interpret it and develop a program that's a sort of a holistic health program. Henry has adapted that into a modern technique, which I describe in detail, in which you and a group of friends join together for what he calls the dream tent, where you create a sacred space for this experience, and your friends focus on you, or sometimes when something is bothering you too much to really stay focused on it,
right, just
you have a person who volunteers to be a surrogate dreamer, and everyone in the group focuses on that person, and they have a dream for you, and then you interpret the dream. It's exactly the same kind of thing that was done at Epidaurus. So there are a number of techniques that we can use in order to open to this aspect of non-local awareness using dreams. I mean, dreams have been associated with precognitive experiences, Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. I mean, lots and lots, you know, in the Bible there are lots of sort of precognitive dream interpretations.
Do you think people could be so powerful in their dreams that they could actually harm someone else? Do they have that kind of power?
Yes, I should think. I mean, I know of no experiment that would do that, but I am reminded, for instance, of the work of Carol Nash at the University of Pittsburgh.
Oh, sure.
And he carried out an experiment where people sent healing. There were three colonies. He developed a colony of cells, and then he split them into three subgroups, one for positive treatment, one for negative treatment, and one as a control that nothing happened. And he had people who were in the positive group send positive healing energy to the cells, and then the people in the negative group sent negative thoughts to the cells. And he discovered that both the negative and the positive groups were significantly affected when compared to controls, but that the positive group was more affected than the negative group, which is what you'd expect because the universe supports stasis and harmony. And but both the positive and the negative intention produced positive results. So, yes, I mean, I think that's the basis of voodoo and all of these practices. These are rituals that allow us to open to this part of ourselves so that we can express intention. And the important part is that, you know, you really can strip away the sort of religious connotations. And the reason that all of this is so intertwined with religion is that for most of human history, there was no other way to think about it. The science is, you know, science is only a couple hundred years old.
Sure.
So prior to the development of a methodical protocol for science, scientific method, the only way you could really interpret a precognitive dream that you had was that the gods were speaking to you. And I believe, looking at the research, and I actually think this is one of the most important conclusions that I have reached, is that moments of religious ecstasy, moments of creative genius, whether it's a scientist or a composer or a painter, and moments of remote viewing, where someone's just describing a teacup, are essentially the same experience modulated by context and intention. That is, the religious ecstatic is trying to have an epiphany. They want to see God. And so that's the way they have the experience. The scientist is trying to find out a fundamental principle. So that's the kind of experience they have. And the remote viewer is just trying to describe a teacup or, you know, a picture. The interesting thing is that the first two, the religious ecstasy and the moment of creative genius, they are so life transformational for the people who have them that how they got to them, it's hard for them to really focus on that because the experience itself becomes so transformational. Whereas in a remote viewing experiment, the experience is significant but not life transformational. And therefore, you can study how it actually happened. And that's how the techniques that have evolved around remote viewing and those same insights, the numinosity, the entropy idea, they carry over into the religious ecstasy and into the moment of creative genius. And it's really telling us something about the nature of consciousness and how we get this information. Because if you look at the words of the people who actually have the experiences, the Mozarts, the Copelands, the Beethovens,
mm-hmm.
the Einstein.
Geniuses.
The series, yeah, whether they're geniuses, religious ecstatics, or creative artists.
But whatever they are, they're the best at their specific thing.
That's right. And I describe this in detail. There's six steps involved in this process, and they're learnable steps. But these people are all describing the same thing. They all talk about this connection with a greater whole. They all talk about this sense of being linked up. They talk about it as occurring in a timeless time.
Yep.
They describe it as having a kind of holistic nature so that it's like a hologram where you can see it from every angle. If you look at Picasso's paintings, what he's trying to express is this multi-angle perspective. Whether it's a religion or creativity or just remote viewing, it seems to be the same thing at its essence.
Why do you tie in near-death experiences and reincarnation with this?
Well, because the same aspect of consciousness that exists outside of time-space is the thing that has the near-death experience. I mean, if you talk to near-death people, what do they talk about? They say, I have this sense that I was linked with this great loving whole. I see this beam of light. I suddenly had a sense of knowing of all kinds of things. Fear fell away, all that sort of thing. I'm in this timeless place. It's another aspect of this non-local consciousness. Reincarnation is, well, something survives, clearly. If you look at the work of Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker, Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia, for instance, which is really the only significant reincarnational research of quality. The sort of thing they've been looking at about children who come in with birthmarks and scars of injuries that relate to previous lives that they check out. All of this is saying to us, some aspect of us exists outside of time-space.
So they believe this.
Yes. Well, the evidence, it's not a matter of belief, it's that there's no countervailing evidence.
I wonder, though, if they believed this, Stephen, before they found the evidence. See,
no, in many cases they did not.
They did not. I always did.
Oh, well, people instinctively have a feeling for this.
Yes.
Obviously, you've chosen to do a radio program that deals with these subjects, and that's clearly, I mean, because it resonates with you in a way that it doesn't resonate with Glenn Beck.
True.
I think we, as I said earlier, it's like any skill set. There are some people who have a natural affinity for it. I mean, you know, I could take piano lessons or violin lessons for the rest of time, and none of the major players in the world would ever be in any way threatened.
You would not be in a symphony. That's
no. I was a kid who flunked tissue paper and comb.
Uh-huh.
So, but there are other things that we have different skill sets.
We excel at certain things.
Yeah, and I mean I've looked at hundreds of people. I figured it out when I wrote the book, 25,000 remote viewing sessions. For instance, people like Michael Crichton, who's a wonderful remote viewer, participated in a number of experiments, as I describe, and you can see why his sort of futuristic fiction is sometimes so on the mark.
Yes, good point.
You know, Andromeda Strain. Sometimes he's way off. I mean, he and I do not agree on global warming, but
well, he may be way off at this point, at least.
Yeah, but in any case, you see this again. You know, Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote Treasure Island, tells us that the gremlins of the mind wrote the stories. Jonas Salk talks about the role of dreams, his dream life, and the role that it played in his creative process. Just over and over, when you actually talk to people who have these experiences, or you read their biographies or their journals or the stories that they told other people contemporaneously, you see over and over again this same connection, timelessness, holographic linkage to a greater whole. Over and over again, they articulate this.
Do you believe you were reincarnated, Stephen?
Yes.
Me too. Me too.
Yes. I not only believe it, but have had several experiences that absolutely convince me of it.
What do you think, or who do you think you were?
Oh, no particular personality. I couldn't tell you that. But I have had experiences where I have... I'll tell you one that I had actually not very long ago, completely unexpectedly. My sister lives in France in the Dordogne, and I was over visiting her and my brother-in-law, and we had all been reading the Da Vinci Code, and I knew there were in the Dordogne region, there are a number of Merovingian and Templar sites that are associated with that story, and that's a whole other, that's to a whole other program on that. But
right.
Anyway, my sister said, well, you know, there's this famous Templar church that's just not very far from here. I'll take you down to it. So we got in the car. This was last winter, and it was cold, and she didn't want to get out of the car. She said the church won't be heated. It's not used anymore. Mm-hmm. You can go on up. And I walked into this church, and I want to tell you, this doesn't even sound rational. I realize I say this to people on radio, makes you sound like a bit of a loon, but it's absolutely, that was the experience. I walked into this place, and I stood there, and I suddenly had this sort of frisson, a kind of thrill goes through your body. And I looked down at my leg, I looked down at myself, and I was wearing armor. I was a young man, about 26 Whoa. Years old. I had blonde hair. I was very tired, unshaven, smelly. I was standing there in armor. I had a sword. I was just a fighter.
Yeah.
And I was looking at down this nave of this church, which has not changed from that day to this. And I realized I had seen this when I walked into the church.
You'd been there.
The first thing I got was, I'm telling you the story of the hair on my arms is standing up. I walked into this church, and I knew I had been in this church, and this thing sort of went through me, and I looked down. It just happened in an instant. I mean, it was bing, and it was gone. But for that instant, I was standing there in battered armor, holding a sword, sweaty. My hair was all stringy, unshaven. Had clearly just been in some kind of battle. Boom, it was just that single hit, and then it was gone. That kind of thing convinces me that consciousness carries over. I don't think I'm coming back or you're coming back, but patterns of memory will come back. We're not coming back. That is, there's nothing that I see in any of the research or in any reading any of the sources that I have looked at over the years that suggests that you will be back, but that that some aspect of higher consciousness will manifest another personality, and that personality will bring in a series of behavioral patterns and attitudes, I think seems very clear to me.
When does it stop? When does it stop coming back?
Well, if you follow most of the great spiritual teachers, it's when you have reached a point where you have divested yourself of attachments.
Perfection?
Perfection is very hard for me to imagine. So, given what I know about myself, it's just, don't get ahead of yourself. But what I do think is that you get to a place where things do not drag on you, where you really are in the now. And it's taken me a long time to begin to understand what, all these spiritual teachings talk about being in the now. What in the world does that mean? And I think what it means is that you are not playing a script from past memory. Then I would have said, and then I'm going to do this. That, you're going to a meeting with a new person, a woman you're interested in, or a friend or something, and as you're driving there, you're playing out the script of what's going to happen, only you get there and you find out everybody else has got a different script.
Stay with us, Stephen. We're going to come back on our script in a moment. We'll take phone calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Stephen Schwartz, our guest, and we're going to take your phone calls as well. We're talking about the ability, the incredible ability of the mind and consciousness, remote viewing as well. Stephen, do you get spiritual when you were doing some of this work?
Well, I consider myself a deeply spiritual person because the experiences that I have had all have left me with that perspective. I can't say that I'm not a churched person, but I am a spiritual person. I guess as I get older, I become more and more Buddhist. But I really, because of the sense of this greater whole, and many people have strongly spiritual experiences when they do these things. And the reason, I think, is that that is the context in which we have been culturally trained to consider these things. It's either that or it gets wound up in occultism, and, you know, it's Zirkzon in the Council of Nine is talking to me. So there's no question that these kinds of altered states of consciousness have a component in them that is that leads people to have very spiritual feelings.
Let's go to some of the phone calls here. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead. And where are you calling from? Sure.
I'm calling from Oklahoma.
Okay.
I'm Amy. I had a question about reincarnation. I believe that I've lived former lives. I've had different experiences that kind of lead me in that direction of thinking. I believe that I was hanged before. The reason being, I cannot stand anything around my neck. And in heightened state of either sadness, anger, heightened emotion, I get like an heart-shaped redness around my neck that is unexplainable. Have you ever heard anything to that instance?
There are a number of cases that people have described. The point you make about a heightened state of emotion is very typical about people who are opening up to some aspect of non-local consciousness. It's one of the reasons that early man, and the Native Americans always associate these things with rituals. There's a lot of emotion around them for just that reason.
Would there be a change in color and actual skin tone?
I have never heard of anybody who had your particular manifestation, but as I was saying earlier, there are a number of cases there where children, for instance, have been born with birthmarks that that correspond with injuries that they say they have received in an earlier life, and when they go back and check, it turns out that this is true. So you may very well be giving an extremely accurate description. I don't question it.
And just one other thing, the actual feel of raw cotton has always just made my skin crawl. And I have always had calluses on my fingertips, whether one thing or the other. Now it's because of my guitar playing, but actually the actual feel of the cotton, such as if I drove past Mississippi and Alabama, and just to drive through those cotton fields, it made my skin crawl. And I have no reason in this life for it to get me that kind of effect.
I understand. That is a very typical response of someone whom I think is having a reincarnational memory. When you have a response to something that there's no reason you ought to have that response, or that it's completely unfamiliar, and yet you have a really strong emotional response to it, you're dealing with these kinds of memory patterns.
Stephen, do you think that our government truly stopped its remote viewing program? I know everybody I've interviewed who used to be part of SRI says, yes, they did, but maybe they didn't. Maybe they went in with other people.
Well, you know, I get asked this question all the time. The answer is, of course, it could be, and it could be so dark that nobody knew anything about it. I actually don't think so, though, because part of the reason that the government got out of this was because of Christian fundamentalists who found the idea of they have a very odd idea about what remote viewing is and took great exception to it. And I think in the current, particularly over the last 6 years, the idea that there would be any funding of something in this area, I find very difficult to take aboard. I also think that if it were going on, there would be tremors of it within the remote viewing research community because, you know, we're not a very big group. There may be 10 or 15 scientists who have looked at this question. And when I ask them, including the guys, as you have already said, you've interviewed, when I've asked them, they don't know anything about it. I don't know anything about it. So I tend to think that the government is not doing that. They are doing healing research.
How so?
Well, the NIH, NIMH, National Institutes of Health, has put up funding for several large studies that are going on looking at healing. And that's an entire area, you know, that is related to remote viewing. In my estimation, in my view, there are really only two kinds of phenomena in this area. There is non-local perturbation, that's consciousness affecting another organism or a mechanical system, and non-local perception, that's opening yourself to information. Remote viewing is in that category. But there are a number of studies. In fact, I'll tell you one that is so, that I think is one of my favorites because it is so reality challenging. It's done by a man named Leon Leibovici. It was published in the British Medical Journal. Leibovici is a cardiologist in Israel working at the big medical center there.
All right.
And he had a 2,993 people who had been admitted to the hospital and who had contracted a very particular kind of blood disease selected by the computer. And then these people had all been out of the hospital 4 to 10 years. So they were long out of the hospital.
Right.
And knew nothing about this. And he had 2,000 of them split into two populations, 1,000 each. One group was treated, one group is control. The treateds were the targets of healing energy that was sent to them by people who knew only their first names. And then he examined the records. Remember, they'd been out of the hospital 4 to 10 years, and he discovered that those people who were the focus of therapeutic intention had fewer complications,
mm-hmm.
less use of medication, less pain, quicker recovery times. This was a man who was a stone skeptic and who did this experiment principally to prove that therapeutic intention was not real. And so he constructed what he considered to be a very elegant, the most rigorous possible experiment. That is, he was going to get people to pray for people 10 years after the fact.
Right.
And it worked. And it was so rigorously done that when he submitted it to the British Medical Journal, which is one of the four big journals in the world in medicine, they published it. It got through peer review, and they published it because nobody could find any fault with the experiment. And he concludes, the skeptic, he says, after having done this study, I have to conclude that therapeutic intention ought to be part of clinical practice.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, this is Justin from KFAB in Omaha.
Sure, Justin, thank you.
I just wanted to let you know, actually, George, I've been listening to this show since I was a little pup, so it's first-time calling. It's kind of exciting.
Great, I'm glad you're aboard.
I just had a quick question. I'm actually really interested in cognitive science,
mm-hmm.
especially regarding human-computer interaction, and this is a little bit off-topic, but I just kind of wanted to get Mr. Schwartz's thoughts on the holographic mind theory in relation to cognition.
Okay.
And I'll actually just hang up and listen.
Well, unpack your question a little more. That's such a big topic.
Yeah, you still with us, Justin?
Yeah, I am.
Okay,
I am.
Go ahead.
I apologize. It's
fine.
Just, like, I guess more in relation to remote viewing and what we're talking about. I mean, are they even related or?
I'm not quite clear, Justin, what you're trying to ask me. So, is remote viewing related to holographic mind theory? Is that what you're trying to ask me?
Essentially, yeah. I just wanted to get your general thoughts on it in the first place, but, you know, on topic in relation to.
All right. Well, the thing about the remote viewing experience is its holographic quality. And clearly, since it's being filtered through the brain, I mean, remote viewing, it doesn't just hang in the air. You are a filter, and that's part of the problem, is that you have to train yourself to suspend judgment and analysis. But the experience itself is notable for its holographic quality, this sense of sort of knowing in all concepts. And in remote viewing, what we've discovered is you can go back again and again with people and get more and more detail. It has a very fractal quality.
The fact that so many people are beginning to try this, what does that tell you, Stephen? What's happening here?
Well, I think there's a change in the zeitgeist going on. I think it's being brought on by global warming. I think the whole Atlantis myth, for instance, is essentially a precognitive myth. That is, it is an event in human history that is so numinous, so highly charged emotionally, that people have been precognizing it for thousands of years, going all the way back to Plato, and that it gets recontextualized in each generation by, you know, a culturally appropriate myth in that form. But that what these people are really looking at is global climate change. If you look at, well, just to give you an example of the Casey material, we started with that. Edgar Casey talks about Atlantis a great deal. It's very, very difficult, thanks to the mitochondrial DNA research that has been done, it's very difficult to find a period of thousands of years where a high civilization could have developed that's unaccounted for. It just, that's a whole other subject, but it's very improbable. And yet, the story of Atlantis occurs over and over and over, and various people bring the story forth in slightly different variants. So what is it that's going on? And I think what's going on is that people have been precognizing for 2,000 years, have been remote viewing an event which is in our future and now not in our very distant future. In the Casey material, for instance, he says the Atlanteans took cargo to the star with stars with sails. Well, if you look at a space probe, what does it look like? A piece of cargo when the solar panels are extended, they look like sails. Well, he was doing that in 1927 before there were space probes. I mean, how else could he have described it? It looks like a piece of cargo with sails on it. He says that the Atlanteans were fooling with the stuff of life, and that they were breeding unnatural couplings, but not physical, but unnatural blendings of species that would never normally have happened. And there's a whole area of genetic engineering that has grown up now about what are called chimeras, which are there are ethical debates now about if you use...
Oh, that's animal crosses, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
If you use human DNA, how much of a humanness does an animal have to have in order to qualify as a human? And there are very serious discussions that are going on in the neurosciences literature about how do we know we're not trapping a human consciousness in an animal body? My point being that Casey's description of the Atlanteans as creating what he calls the things, which are these crossings, sounds very much to me like exactly what's going on now. He talks about crystals. Now, everybody always sees these as some sort of crystals like the Clark Kent, you know, the Superman place.
Yeah.
Up in the. But really, if you think about it, what are we talking about here? We're talking about silicon chips and nanotechnology and things like that. So I think the part of the problem in listening to people talk from a non-local awareness perspective is that the language that they use is often an approximation of what they're experiencing because they literally lack the language to describe what they're seeing. I mean, if you were trying to remote view television from the 18th century, or if you were trying to explain television to an 18th century person, I mean, what would you say? There's a box that sits on a table in your living room?
And they'd think there was a physical little people in there.
Yeah, the little, you know, little tiny midgets have been, I mean, you can see where that goes. So it's very difficult to, if you get too far out ahead of the remote viewing, I mean, you asked me earlier, could you go to this, you know, go to other planets? Could you go into the future? I, for instance, have been asking people since 1978 to remote view the year 2050.
Why 2050?
Because if you go much further out than that, you can't understand what they're saying. And I have already encountered that. But I have also, beginning in 1978, they described AIDS for me. They said, well, there's this, I was very concerned about nuclear war. Remember, this is 1978. We're mm-hmm. in the middle of the Cold War. And I said, well, has there been a nuclear exchange? And no. And then they would say things like, well, one of the superpowers, the Soviet Union has disappeared. And I thought, what? What do you mean it's disappeared? How could it disappear? It's a huge country.
Yeah, one would assume it got blasted away, but no, that's not what they meant.
Exactly, but you see, they couldn't articulate it, and I didn't have enough sense because of my own limitations.
Yes, to understand.
I just couldn't imagine asking the question the right way.
That geopolitically fell apart.
Yes. They've described for me, anyway, they talked about this blood disease that would come out of Africa from crossing over from primates and that it would kill millions of people. And that it lurked in the body for years. And I went up to Dave Robinson, who was then the deputy director of the cardiovascular research at NIH, who was a friend. And I said, what is this? And he said, I haven't a clue. This is 1978, 79.
Incredible.
Of course, in 80, 81, the first accounts of AIDS.
Yep.
And their description turns out to be exactly dead on.
Whether it was done in a test tube or not, the point is they got it right, didn't they?
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that I'm looking for, and I think it may be Storn, S-T-E-O-R-N, this Irish company that has this over-unity technology we're going to find out in January, about July about. But one of the things that they tell me about 2050 is that there's been this energy revolution, and energy is just no longer an issue. And I said, well, what do you mean it's no longer an issue? Well, you go down to the store and you buy one of these boxes. And you buy a little box for a little purpose and a big box for, you know, to power an apartment building, and you just plug it in. And I said, well, what do you mean you plug it in? Well, it's this box, and you kind of plug it into the system, and it provides energy, and you don't, energy is not an issue.
Stephen, sit with us. We'll come right back. We'll take final phone calls. Fast night on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Stephen, let's go to the phones, pick up some final calls here. Hello, okay. Wildcard Line. How are you?
Hi, this is John Mark calling from West Hollywood.
Hi, right up the street. Go ahead, John Mark.
Great show tonight, and Mr. Schwartz, you're a wealth of information that is pretty much right on the money. There's certain guests that are amazing, and you're definitely one of them.
Well, thank you.
I think that just the fact that your sister lived not too far from that church, did you say?
Oh, in the Dordogne? Yes.
Yeah, just that in itself speaks volumes, my friend. Have you, I mean, the chances of that, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes, yes.
Have you ever heard of Dr. Bernard Heisch and the God
Theory? Oh, yes, of course. Bernie Heisch, yes, I know him.
And what do you think of his work?
I like him a lot. I think he's a very interesting guy. He does some very interesting research.
Yeah.
He's a well-trained scientist who's arrived at, I think, well-grounded conclusions, and also a very nice person.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's what you're saying, what he says, what Lynn McTaggart says, et cetera. I think it's really speaks to the truth.
Thank you. Well, you know, I mean, if you do the research long enough, the evidence is pretty compelling. It's not like it offers you a lot of options.
Right. I mean, as you're saying it, I'm sure people, it resonates. It's almost as if we're remembering it as you say it.
I think that's true because I think we all have access to this. We all process this. It's just below the surface, which is why you walk into a place and you have a sense you've been there before, or you meet somebody and you feel like you've known them forever, and you meet somebody else and they're utter strangers.
Absolutely. Which brings me right to the moment right now with me talking to you. So there's people like you that are out there that are speaking the truth, and thank you so much for doing that.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Your turn. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Hey.
How you doing?
Good, sir.
I love your guys' shows. You and Art, you're the best. So
thank you.
Mr. Schwartz.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How
good.
About yourself?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm wondering about remote viewing. I know the U.S. military has shut it down years ago, but Homeland Security, I'm thinking maybe they've been smart enough to pick it up. And with the recent plot we had with Fort Dix and blowing up the military, had they had anything to do with that, or was that foiled from a totally different situation?
I think that was foiled because of that worker at that photo place that they took the video in to have transferred over to a DVD.
Right.
Just the one particular situation there that put it out in the open there, huh?
Sure did.
I believe so. But, you know, if you look at Opening to the Infinite, I describe in detail with all the pictures and the drawings and everything about the 47 people that just on the spur of the moment I asked them to describe Saddam Hussein and where he would be when he was located. And I don't think there's any question that this can be used and is used quite regularly. I mean, for instance, in criminology, it's amazing the number of law enforcement people, very quietly mostly, sort of off the books, are working with remote viewers of one kind or another. I was very surprised when I did research for the book about how many cases there were, and some of them are quite startling.
I've seen a number of them on a cable TV, and I'm just wondering if, do you think Homeland Security might be involved in that too, or are they just,
you know,
totally
as I
denied?
Said earlier, I don't think the U.S. government is doing very much with this. I think they're doing consciousness research in other areas, but the kind of remote viewing that was going on at SRI, no, I do not believe that is going on.
Okay. Well, keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you.
I appreciate your information.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, next up, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yeah, well, I've been listening to your program and first-time caller, and I have a question. Did you ever think that it might possibly tie in? I had a revelation in 1990. I'd been sitting on a mountain watching the sunset into the Gulf on the island of Jamaica, and I had a revelation that the access to the brain that y'all are talking about may possibly come into the fact that we lost our brains, so to speak, at least according to the Bible and quite a few other different things along the lines that animals use most of their brain and the humans use, less than 20%?
Well, that's certainly true. We only use a portion of our mental capacity, no question about that.
But wouldn't it also tie in the fact that, I mean, you know, it may not have been an apple, so to speak, but, I mean, that would have been part of it. If we were conscious with a being or something, whatever, you know, Buddha, God, whatever you want to call it, a supreme being, we would have had access, and we would have been able to, you know, imagine, if you would, you and I sitting down together, you know, closing our eyes and suddenly saying, okay, I'll race you to the moon. Now, if we were in that conscious state, we would be in the same state as that being, would we not?
Well, I'm not sure I totally understand what you're saying, but yes. I mean, I will tell you that I think that this ability began to be suppressed when we urbanized, when people began to live in gatherings as opposed to being hunter-gatherers. And the reason was that it was too invasive. I mean, when you walk down the street of the village, do you really want to know what everybody thinks about your hairdo? No, of course not. And so I think we began to close this down. Not entirely, though, because, for instance, studies have shown that CEOs of corporations who were good at remote precognitive remote perception do better on tests when they're tested. The ones that do the best make the most money. Their corporations make the most money. There was a book called Executive ESP that was written a number of years ago by Doug Dean and a researcher named John Michalowski at the Newark Technological Institute that reports on
studies looking at why CEOs do particularly well at remote perception tasks.
All right, I like that. You know what? I've always believed that you have to have some intuitiveness about this, some remote viewing abilities to succeed in the corporate world.
Absolutely. Well, you know, intuition is just remote perception. It's non-local perception modulated by experience. That's what we call intuition. It's just you open up to this aspect of self, and then you modulate it by the experience and judgment you have. And people in our culture, you know, it doesn't go away. We just call it a gut feeling or women's intuition, or we have lots of words for it, but all of them are describing. Intuition is a nice word because it's a nice neutral term, doesn't offend anybody. Everybody knows about intuition. But basically, intuition is fundamentally a form of non-local perception.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, it's Cassandra in West Hollywood.
Hi.
I mean Culver City. if you're being someone's doing remote viewing of you, can you see that person?
You mean, do you know you're being remote viewed?
Some people can have that ability.
Yes. So, there are not a lot of studies, but there are a few studies that people were able to know. And there is another related area of research called DeMille's, Distant Mental Influence Over Living Systems, begun by William Broud, who's now up at California Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. And William's written a very good book on this. And people know when they're being stared at. And he's done a very elegant, very, very carefully controlled experiment that shows over and over again that when someone stares at you, I mean, not you physically, but just looking at a picture of you on a television set, that your brain responds to being stared at. And of course, we all have the experience of pulling up to a light on a street and feeling stared at and looking over, and by God, somebody's staring at us.
Sometimes the wrong person.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other issue. But the answer to your question, caller, is that yes, people do have the ability to know when they're being remote viewed or when people are aware of them.
Let's go to our next wild card line. That you're up with Stephen Schwartz on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi there. How y'all doing tonight?
We're well, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. You had said that nobody had ever given you a good answer on why creation and evolution couldn't work together, and the answer to that is they're at war with one another. They're totally opposites in almost every way. I'm just a lowly truck driver, but I'll try to explain it as best I can. And it's, boy, you could do a whole show on this. Creation says that God created the world, and evolution says that something evolved and that it became better than its comrades, and all they died or were eaten or something and got better. Creation says that God created everything, and there was no death on the earth until Adam and Eve sinned. The complications of evolution is so evil. You know, Darwin named his book, you know, The Origin of the Species and the Natural Selection of the Favored Races.
That's not correct. I mean, you believe what you want to believe, but that is not the title of the book.
I see. Well, Hitler believed in evolution. That's why he killed the Jews. He believed that the Jews were mostly all ape, and that the Aryan race had evolved into God-like people.
No, Hitler went after the Jews because in his occult believings, he saw a great battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and he thought the Jews were part of the Ahrimanic forces. And I mean, he had a whole occult theology that he had worked out, which really was mostly cribbed from a misunderstanding of Rosicrucianism, a little Freemasonry thrown in there, a little alchemical material, and particularly the anthroposophical work of Rudolf Steiner.
I was going to say, who screwed him up? Somebody did a long time ago.
Huh? I think he was screwed up at a number of levels. What's actually very interesting is that if you go back and you look at the remote perception information about Hitler that was occurring prior to 38, you hear people describing him saying this is this great being who has to make a choice. He's either going to turn to the light or he's going to turn to the darkness. And then, for instance, the Edgar Cayce material in 1938, with the beginning of the phony war, he says the choice has been made, the die is cast, he's chosen darkness. I mean, no question that, I mean, if you look at Hitler as a personality, I mean, look back at him now, he just seems kind of bizarre. I mean, you look at his speeches and everything, and yet you have to ask yourself, what was it about this man that so catalyzed an entire country of very sober people? I mean, the Germans are not given to flightiness, that the entire country was willing to march in lockstep. And there's a wonderful quote from Albert Speer, who was his architect, and he said...
He was a Pied Piper.
That's exactly. He said, you know, if he had no ability to resist him. If he walked in the room today, this was after he had been in Spandau prison for years.
Yeah.
If he walked in the room today, I could not deny him.
Amazing. Let's go to West of the Rockies. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, this is McAllister in Seattle.
Yeah, what a wonderful name.
Thank you very much. Stefan, I read Psychic Archaeology when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really excited by it, and I started to try to psychometrize.
Mm-hmm.
And I write down questions, a number of them, on pieces of paper, so I'm not sure which one I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done ancestry that way. And my father was illegitimate, and his father was illegitimate, and there's illegitimacy in my mother's family, so I was dying to know things. And I really did get information for real. You just sit there and you see things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so it's a treat to have you on the program tonight.
Well, thank you. By the way,
mm-hmm.
Benjamin Franklin, he had an illegitimate son. His illegitimate son had an illegitimate son. And his illegitimate son had an illegitimate son. So that's no bar from greatness.
Let's go to final calls here. First-time caller line, you're up. Hi there.
Hello, how are you tonight?
We are well, thanks.
Okay, I have a quick question. Something happened to me, and I'd like to see if I can get an opinion,
okay,
if it's something from the future, the past, or whatever.
Sure thing. We got about 2 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll make it faster than that. I'm in my early 50s. For the first probably 30 years of my life, I had sleeping dream and conscious dream of a
mm-hmm.
house, the same house over and over and over.
Hmm.
I drew it. I described it to my father, to my mother. Nobody'd ever see anything. I just dismissed it. It went away. And all of a sudden, one day, I'm driving home from work by Oakland, California. I look over at this hill, and I get freezing cold chills and decide that's where the house is.
Hmm. And did you go over and see?
I never had the courage to go over and look for it. I'm sorry to admit it, but I was afraid.
Well, I understand that. This sounds like some kind of really potent memory that you had brought in of something that had happened. I mean, I'll share with you very quickly before we go. I had quite a similar experience a number of years ago, before I knew anything about any of this, in York, Pennsylvania, and I went up to the house, and I knocked on the door, and I said to the woman who answered, a young woman, I said, all I want to know is, do you have striped wallpaper? And you have a big cherry tree in the backyard. And she looked at me like I was crazy. And then from behind her, this very elderly voice said, not since I was 14. My father repapered the living room, and we cut down the tree after a blight attacked it. And opened the door, and it was a woman about 90 years old, 95 years old, who was the grandmother of this young woman who was in her 20s. I can't tell you why I had the experience. I can't tell you what it means. All I can tell you is I was driving down the street. I had the same experience. I had chills. I went up. I knocked on the door and asked this question, and it turned out to be right.
Stephen, as I do a quick remote view, why do I have this perception that you're in some kind of leather chair or couch? Might you be?
I am sitting in a black leather chair where I have been sitting all night. You're absolutely right on the money.
Amazing, isn't that? Stephen, thank you so much. The book, Opening to the Infinite. Good luck with it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, my friend. How about that? For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.